This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guests this morning are Nick Abraham, Communications and Accountability Manager for Washington Conservation Voters and Washington Environmental Council, and Christopher Wirtz-Vicky, Interim Executive Director of FutureWise. Washington Conservation Voters, Washington Environmental Council, and FutureWise are all members of the Environmental Priorities Coalition, a network of over 20 leading environmental groups in Washington State that influence policy at the state level. Nick Abraham and Chris Wirtz-Vicky are here to tell us about environmental legislation in the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session, which began on January the 9th. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about the Environmental Priorities Coalition?
The Environmental Priorities Coalition has been around since 2003. We're a collection of leading groups in the state that try and work on policy, like you said. But this year, we're really excited about having the most diverse set of priorities that affect people all across the state. So whether you live on Orcas Island in Yakima or downtown Tacoma, these priorities are going to affect your life in a really positive way.
What are the priorities of the Environmental Priorities Coalition for the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session?
So the priorities this year are water for people, farms, and fish, and oil transportation safety, and protecting all communities from toxic pollution. So what we're looking at is bills to try and prevent disasters from oil spills, from rail traffic coming through communities across the state, and preventing toxic pollution and fully funding the state's toxic cleanups all across the state.
Would you say more about why these particular priorities were chosen this year?
Yeah, so all the groups get together and talk about what they want to put forth each year. And we really wanted to have a diverse set of priorities that protected our state in a fully comprehensive way. So we all got together and decided that these three were the most impactful things that we could have a substantial effect right now. But we're also ones that legislators and people from all walks of life could get behind and really support.
Would you comment on the likely political environment for environmental legislation in the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session?
This year, there's a lot of focus on fully funding education. There's a shortfall that I think a lot of people have heard about of roughly a couple billion dollars. So there's going to be a lot of divisiveness on trying to figure out the best way to fund that. But there's a lot of other issues that we need to focus on that really affect people right now. And it's make sure that we don't undercut some of the solutions to our problems by trying to fully fund education.
Let's focus now on the Water for People, Farms, and Fish initiative. What is the reason for this initiative? What's the purpose?
So this is Chris, and I'll just tell you just a couple of things about FutureWise first. FutureWise is a nonprofit organization, Washington's only land use planning advocacy nonprofit in the state. We were established in 1990 as kind of a watchdog organization on the state's growth management laws, which were put into effect in 1990. And we've been working to shape those laws since then. We have an urban and a rural program. We focus on protecting natural resource areas like farms and forests and wetland buffer areas, and also on urban issues like affordable housing, complete streets, et cetera. So this is an issue, this water issue, that's near and dear to our heart. It's intended to protect the outcome of a state Supreme Court decision that we won earlier this year related to water rights. In some ways, water rights are a really simple thing, and in some ways, they're actually really very complex. In the simplest description, water rights in Washington were established over 100 years ago as something called first in time, first in right. Essentially, that means if you secured water in a certain location first, you had the first right to use it. If a person came along next, could also secure rights to water in a particular place. But if at some point in the future there was a water shortage, the person who was there first, the senior water rights holder, would have the claim to all the water that was within their rights. And in the end, it's possible that there might not be enough water in the system for everybody who holds rights in the system. So in some ways, Washington State has managed this water rights system very well. In some ways, they haven't, and it's very complicated. But as it relates to this particular Supreme Court decision that we're trying to protect, the Hearst decision, the issue is fairly simple. The decision affirms existing Washington laws by stating that cities and counties have to plan for new development in rural areas in accordance to how much groundwater is available to serve them. Planning for growth in conjunction with available water is an issue that's outlined in our growth management laws and has been for several decades. But cities and counties have chosen to ignore this part of the law through a process called the permit-exempt well. This is a well that a single-family homeowner uses and drills to provide water to their single-family home in a rural area. And by allowing these wells to be drilled without the planning behind them for water availability and without first securing water rights in accordance with water law, this flies in the face of all the laws that we've been putting forth related to water and land use planning. So why has this been happening? Simply put, there's two main reasons for this. The first is that until recently, nobody thought that individual wells for single-family homes was going to have that big of an impact on the water system as a whole. You can imagine 100 or 50 years ago that single wells for a single home really weren't adding up to that much water overall. However, we know today that the accumulation of all of these wells really does add up to a lot of water. Not only does it add up to a lot of water, but the amount of water that's being used isn't just depleting groundwater sources, but it's also impacting rivers and streams. This is something that's known as hydraulic continuity, which means that groundwater and surface water interact together in a common system. The Department of Ecology, all the way back in 1985, recognized that this hydraulic continuity was an issue, and they established something called the in-stream flow rule. The rule made certain that rivers and streams had enough water to support wildlife like salmon, birds, etc. And the rule made sure that cities and counties were planning their water resources in a way that would maintain all of these minimum flows. Now, right away, it was obvious that some rivers and streams didn't have adequate water to maintain fish and wildlife habitats. And so the Department of Ecology closed these particular basins to extracting more water. Now, that only applied to agricultural and industrial uses and big users of water. It didn't apply to single-family residence wells, which were being issued through these permit-exempt process. Now, in some places where Department of Ecology closed these basins because there's no water, since that time, in some places, 6,000 permit-exempt wells have been drilled in these basins. And so we are now recognizing that there really is an impact as a result of all of these single-family homes. So we need to plan growth better to be able to put development where there is actually available water resources. Now, the second reason why this has happened is because nobody wants to apply a complicated process to single-family wells. Water is a sacred and precious resource. Nobody wants to have to tell rural property owners that they have to go through a complicated, potentially expensive process in order to provide water to their homes. On top of that, the bureaucratic process involved in managing and permitting all of these individual wells is pretty overwhelming. If you tell a municipal staff in a rural county that they have to start, managing water permits for each new single-family home that goes in, they'll say, we barely have the resources to manage the basic kind of life safety and land use issues we're dealing with. We don't have the resources to deal with managing groundwater in our county. So this environmental priority, we're essentially trying to do two things. First, the bill that we drafted this year and we are supporting this year at the legislature takes a proactive approach to trying to solve this problem of permit-exempt wells. The bill lays out a plan for the creation of mitigation and water banking processes that can be established by cities and counties to better plan for water resources and take some of the burden off of individual homeowners. Now, this isn't something new. Places like Kittitas County and Clallam County have been doing this for a number of years. They've been told through other court decisions that they need to plan specifically for growth in their communities with regards to water. So they're creating kind of tracking and managing programs for water rights and water usage through a program that's available to single-family homeowners. And they've established mitigation measures, which in some cases is actually physically putting water back in the streams at times when there are low flows during the year to be able to mitigate for the impacts of people using water downstream. So, secondly, with this bill, we are trying to push back against two very simple solutions to this problem that we would not like to see come to fruition. One is a simple solution could be that permit-exempt wells are made by law to be outside of Washington state water law, which would kind of completely turn Washington water state law on its head. And we don't want to see, 100 years of those laws overturned. And secondly, another simple solution might be to disconnect land use planning from water availability planning, which is something we also don't want to see. As we just heard today, we've had the third hottest year in a row in terms of climate change. We know that water is going to become more and more of a scarce resource. Now is not the time to be able to allow development to be placed anywhere without consideration for how much water is available. Washington State has some of the strongest growth management laws in the country as it relates to this issue. We want to make sure that those are maintained, and so we're putting forth some solutions to try to solve this problem.
How likely are the mitigation measures that are being proposed likely to really solve the problem with water?
Well, water is a finite resource. There isn't enough of it for everybody. But by planning for it and by putting growth and development in places where we know that there is going to be water available and that that water is legally available to people who are not senior water rights holders, we have a much better chance of being able to extend the use of that water over time. And also single-family residences, in a lot of cases, residences that use wells also use drain fields as opposed to sewer systems. So they're returning some of that water back into the ground. But right now, we have no way to know how much water they're using or how much water they're putting back into the ground because individual wells are not metered. So part of the mitigation and water banking process would also include a metering system so that we could gather more data about how water is used in rural areas.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Nick Abraham, Communications and Accountability Manager for Washington Conservation Voters and Washington Environmental Council, and Christopher Wirtz-Dickey, Interim Executive Director of FutureWise. Our topic is environmental legislation in the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session, and you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. So the proposal that you've just talked about is being put forward as Senate Bill 5024. Who is in favor of the bill, in addition to FutureWise and the Environmental Priorities Coalition?
So we've been working with a number of legislators, primarily Democratic legislators, but also some Republicans as well, to move this bill forward in the legislature. Like I said earlier, we are very concerned about other bills that might come up that would try to kind of reverse the land use planning and water law issues that we have on the books today. And so we're very wary of that and trying to educate legislators about this issue, which is a very complicated issue in a lot of ways. And so it's difficult, but we are down there in Olympia trying to educate folks and to get them to put forth a proactive solution to this problem.
Who's against your bill?
Well, you know, the biggest opponent and the most vocal opponents that we've seen so far are rural property owners, people who own property, either who have not built a house yet or people who would like to subdivide their property and be able to put more houses on them. In some counties, as a result of this case, they are placing new development regulations that say you have to provide proof that there's water before you build a house. And a lot of property owners can't do that right now because the resources aren't available. And so there's kind of a default moratorium in some areas on rural development. And, you know, our goal is not to stop development in rural areas. That is certainly something that's allowed under growth management. But we want to ensure that those houses are built in places where there actually is water. And so part of the solution to this problem is potentially creating a kind of an interim period where people could pay into a mitigation system that is still up and running because it could take 2 to 3 years for a fully running mitigation or water banking system to be up and running. So something that isn't going to completely stop development, but is going to shift it and push it into the right directions. And that will certainly help, you know, rural property owners and single family homeowners.
Let's speak now about efforts to increase oil transportation safety. What laws are already on the books in Washington State to address oil transportation safety?
Well, the last couple of years, there's been a few efforts in the legislature to address oil trains coming through the state and making sure that we have safety precautions in place, as well as first responders having adequate access to supplies to be able to respond when there's a disaster. Unfortunately, those haven't covered every issue and haven't been able to supply quite the amount of safety that we'd like to see. There's a couple of new developments that have really put a lot of pressure on our state. The Kinder Morgan pipeline in British Columbia, if folks have heard about it, is going to be a massive pipeline that comes from Alberta to British Columbia. And once that's put in place, we could see a 700% increase in tanker traffic in Puget Sound. So you can imagine the level of pressure that puts on our first responders. And also, we've seen time and again that if one disaster happens, it can have devastating effects on communities.
What are the specific legislative proposals that are being put forward?
Well, we haven't put forth one just yet, but we have a representative in the House and in the Senate as well to put forth a solution. I don't want to give away who it is before they have a chance to put it forth themselves, but we have people lined up that are ready to put forth solutions to this problem. Right now, Department of Ecology has a $4 million budget hole for their solutions to transportation safety. So we're already in the hole, and we know there's a lot more coming down the line. Last year, the United States lifted its decades-old crude export ban. So that means that there's going to be a lot more oil producers that are likely to be looking elsewhere to send our oil. Washington State has already been a target for oil transportation terminals, so we're likely to see several more coming down the line. Our state already has 5 refineries, and one of the solutions that we're trying to put forth is making sure that if they want to export oil, that people in those communities have a chance to speak on that, voice their concerns about it, and that there's measures in place that they actually have to apply for permits to be able to do that.
What will be the greatest challenges in getting the oil transportation safety legislation passed?
Well, unfortunately, the oil industry still has a lot of money and influence on the legislature, but we know that people in this state understand how dangerous these problems are, and we think if enough people know about the issues and understand what's available, they'll speak up and we can push the legislature to do the right thing.
Now let's talk about your priority of reducing toxic pollution in all communities, which involves securing funding for the Model Toxics Control Act. What is the purpose of the voter-approved Model Toxics Control Act?
Well, the Model Toxics Control Act does three things. It helps clean up toxic cleanup sites, which when this law was first passed, there was over 12,000 sites in the state. We've cut about half of those down. There's a little under 6,000 of them left. But that's still a lot of work for us to clean up and really make sure that we help communities that are really being hit hardest by this. The second thing that it does is help prevent toxic pollution from coming to communities. So that's everything from stormwater pollution to manufacturing pollutants and things from the petroleum industry. The last is helping communities have their own say and influence over how these decisions are made and what is going to be most helpful for them. So there's a program to help communities do their own projects.
Would you go into more detail about some of the types of projects funded by the Model Toxics Control Act, particularly the ones preventing pollution?
Stormwater runoff is a big one. So when cars leak oil, when there's a lot of dispersed places where pollution is coming from, stormwater can come through and wash those into our lakes and rivers and streams. So one of the big ways to prevent that is having rain gardens and permeable surfaces that can have the water not just wash down into rivers, but actually be able to hold in the soil a little longer. And having lots of vegetation and plants and trees along streams so that they can actually soak up and prevent a lot of that issue.
The Model Toxics Control Act, also known as MTCA, also funds something called public participation grants. And so it's a program that is supposed to bring the public into the process of cleaning up contaminated sites in their communities and get them involved in understanding what the impacts are and getting them to understand and drive the solutions to those problems. Last year, the legislature did not fund the public participation grants, of which there was about $4 million worth of grants that would go to support communities. And so we are also helping to try to push to get those grants funded again this year through that act.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle by mobile app and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guests are Nick Abraham, Communications and Accountability Manager for Washington Conservation Voters and Washington Environmental Council, and Chris Wiertz-Vicky, Interim Executive Director of FutureWise. Our topic is environmental legislation in the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session. What have been the challenges in funding the Model Toxics Control Act?
One of the biggest ones is a huge portion of the funding for this comes from the oil and gas industry. As everyone has probably noticed, oil prices have been down across the country for quite some time, and that's put a big budget hole in our ability to prevent and address toxic pollution. There's currently a $70 million budget hole, and part of what we're putting forth as a solution to this is fixing that immediate need of the $70 million that we're looking for, but also putting in place a floor so that when we see the drastic ebbs and flows of gas prices, we're able to make sure that we have enough funding to be able to prevent toxic pollution and help clean these things up.
Where exactly will the funding come from?
It'll still be the same source, the oil and gas industry, but we're just asking them to up a little bit of the cost for them this year and then having it be a floor so that we know that it's never below a certain amount.
So it would basically be a tax surcharge, is that correct?
Well, that's what it currently is, and yeah, we're just asking for it to be adjusted slightly this year.
And how likely do you think it is that the legislature will be willing to pass this increased rate?
Yeah, we have a long session this year, so there's going to be several months to have discussions and talk about this. But we're really hoping that the impacts that folks see in their districts will help encourage them to be more supportive of this bill. You know, this was approved by a vote of the people, so I think it's been pretty clear that this is an effective, positive solution for the state. So we're really hoping that people can get behind it.
What efforts to address climate change will be made in the 2017 Washington State Legislative Session?
Well, my organizations are part of a group called the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy. We've put together a proposal that looks at how we can address climate pollution in our state that also puts communities first and helps prevent impacts into those communities and really addresses the just transition we can make to a clean energy future. So we put forth a proposal, and Representative Joe Fitzgibbon put a bill into the legislature that's centered on a lot of those principles. So we're really excited to have that discussion and talk about that in the legislature.
Would you go into more detail about the different elements of the bill that's been put forward?
Yeah, well, it's just been put forward last week, and it's his bill, but it's centered on a lot of our principles. What it's going to be doing is helping us transition to a clean energy future. So what that looks like is building things like wind and solar, but it's also about transportation and how we can fix each of these problems in all the areas of the state. So there's a lot of different solutions that people put forth, and this would be charging polluters for what they put into the atmosphere and taking that money and really funding the transition that we can make. So instead of having the funding go to any different kind of solution, people in Washington have shown time and again that they want the funding from things like this to go towards fixing the problem.
To what extent has environmental justice been woven into the bill?
It's front and center in what we want to talk about. Environmental justice is the major concern for the Alliance. We want to make sure that communities aren't left behind in this transition, but also that the people hardest hit by the impacts of climate change will also be put forth as the centerpieces for the solutions.
So Governor Inslee has put forward a carbon tax also. So how does his tax relate to the bill that you've just mentioned?
Well, Governor Inslee has been a champion on climate change and environmental issues throughout his career. He's lived those values and shown that he wants to be finding solutions to this, and we are incredibly grateful to have an executive that focuses on those issues so much. The principles in his bill and what the Alliance's proposal were are really similar. It's a very similar structure that he's put forward. There's just a little bit different funding sources that the bills would go towards.
What is your view of his tax proposal?
Well, it was just introduced last week, so there's still a lot of time to look through it. We're really encouraged that he's putting forth solutions. We are still looking for what exactly all the pieces of it are. We're still going through it, but there's a few months in the legislature, so we're hoping that we can bridge the slight differences in our bills together over the next couple months.
So ultimately, it would become the same proposal. Is that the case?
Or that's possible that we could do that. You know, there's still a lot of people in the legislature that don't believe in climate change and that there's significant opposition. I don't want to undercut how difficult this is going to be. For the last couple of years, we've been trying to push through the legislature, but this isn't the only tool in our toolbox either. Our organizations are prepared to use every means at our disposal to get this passed. This is too important to let sit idly by.
So what will be the next steps if the legislation doesn't pass?
Well, we want to focus on getting it through the legislature and really having that discussion so we can look at all the different pieces of it and try and find, you know, new solutions and work with legislators to find and craft the right piece that works for our state. But it's possible that we could go to the ballot as well with a different solution in the future. We haven't gotten there yet. We want to make sure we talk with the legislature first.
Is there other environmental legislation under consideration in the 2017 Washington State legislative session you'd like to mention?
There will be a lot of bills that come up over the next couple months, we imagine. There's always hundreds of bills that get proposed, but these are the major ones we've chosen this year that I think are the most important and will have the biggest impact.
To what extent do you see the upcoming Trump administration affecting the work you do?
It's definitely something that's hard to avoid. It's a looming concern on everyone's mind about what he'll do that could impact our state. His nominations so far have been really troubling for the environmental community. He has someone that's been an ardent opponent of the fundamental nature of what the EPA does now directing it, and a slew of people that don't believe in climate change that are now going to be in charge of our most important national government functions. So it's something that our members are really concerned about. There's specific appointments that could be a really troubling effect on our state. The Army Corps of Engineers is an appointed position, and that has had really specific impacts on our state. You know, recently the Cherry Point coal export terminal was denied a permit by the Army Corps of Engineers because it had direct impacts on the Lummi Nation's fishing treaty rights. So with a new director in there, it could be something that has a really negative effect on our state. The oil and gas industry has also been really prominently displayed in his cabinet decisions, and they could send a lot more proposals to our state. That's why oil transportation safety has been a really core issue this year, is that we could see a lot more oil trains, pipeline projects popping up, and it's something that we've had to fight over the last couple years. And our communities have shown that this isn't something they want for our state, but we could see a lot more coming down the pipeline.
I also think there's a really important piece around how the administration is going to affect the environmental advocacy community in general. Washington State has a very strong environmental nonprofit community, and the future is kind of uncertain in terms of how people are going to be supporting the environment in the future. There's a lot of concentration of interest and money flowing to organizations that impact people directly, like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood, et cetera. But the environmental community doesn't yet know how these shifts in people's interest are going to impact funding for environmental nonprofits. And that's something that we can't predict and that we're going to have to somehow plan for over the next few years.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Just that this year we're really excited by having a diverse set of impacts that can be a really positive solution for our state. And no matter where you live, this is something that can really help your community and really have a tangible impact that you could see every day.
I would also reiterate that I think that these, although they're complicated issues, are, like Nick said, are things that really impact people's daily lives. And so I would encourage people to look at the website and read about these issues and think about them and contact your legislators about how you feel about it. That's the most important step you can take on these things.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Nick Abraham, Communications and Accountability Manager for Washington Conservation Voters and Washington Environmental Council, and Christopher Wirtz-Bickey, Interim Executive Director of FutureWise. For more information, check on the web at environmentalpriorities.org. Again, that's environmentalpriorities.org. Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and on kexp.org.